Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning. If everyone could please take their seats. My name is Leonard Leo, and I serve as Executive Vice President of the Federalist Society. And on behalf of the directors and officers of the Society, it is my privilege to welcome you to our 25th anniversary convention. This gathering is the culmination of a year-long celebration, one where we have taken note of the growth of our organization and the ways in which, thanks to our thousands of volunteers, we have been instrumental in changing the terms of legal debate in this country. But the past year's celebrations also have helped us to focus on and look to the future, causing us to reflect very seriously at how we can build the next generation of talent to further advance a rule of law grounded in the principles of limited constitutional government. It is especially fitting that this anniversary convention be opened by the U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, the Honorable C. Boyden Gray. Ambassador Gray has, for many years, figured prominently in the Federalist Society's work and efforts. He served as one of the first members of our Board of Visitors, and during his service in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations, gave generously of his time and talent, speaking often and provocatively before the Federalist Society, and helping to nurture a number of our founders and leaders who were serving under him in government. I am sure Ambassador Gray has much to say about the Federalist Society on the occasion of its 25th anniversary, but also as a key representative of the United States in Europe about the subject of our plenary sessions, the idea of American exceptionalism. And so, without further delay, please join me in welcoming Ambassador Boyden Gray.
It really is an honor, and I can't tell you how much of a pleasure, to kick off this conference. I'm sorry that I brought Brussels rain to you. Maybe I can take it back when I leave tonight. But it really is a treat. I want to say that Belgium is in turmoil, and while I'm not the representative to Belgium, that's another ambassador, it isn't irrelevant to me that there has been no government in Belgium now for half a year. And I want to reassure you, nothing has gone wrong. The food is just as good as it ever was. It may be better. The bureaucrats still behave the way they have. At least the national, the super bureaucrats, and it still rains just as much as it used to. So a couple of words before I address your topic. I have been involved with the Federalist Society for a long time. The irony is that my older and now deceased brother, who was an economist, studying under Friedman at Chicago, actually knew about the Federalist Society and was involved long before I was, and was Gene Myers, one of his mentors and great friends. And he was the one who put me onto the Federalist Society and got me into a conference out in San Diego, as I recall, back in the early 80s, shortly after the Federalist Society was formed. And it's just an irony that two of the people who were in on the founding were not lawyers, Gene Meyer and my brother. The story about the Federalist Society that I want to tell you is the difficulty we had getting the then vice president, later president, father of the current president, to make a speech to the Federalist Society. And this is 20 years ago, so the Federalist Society was only about 5 years old, not that well known, a little bit controversial. And we wanted my deputy and I, my deputy being John Schmitz, who wasn't one of the initial founders, but certainly was one of the early backers, wanted to have this speech given at the Federalist Society, where the then vice president could talk about the criminalization of foreign policy and to slam the institution of the independent council. A provocative speech which did get a lot of press and did put the Federalist Society on the map when it was finally done. But the staff that I had to deal with, I won't identify who they were, didn't want the speech to take place. And the president wanted to do it, but the staff wouldn't implement it. So he said to me, at one point he said, now what you got to do is go back to your office and call Brad Reynolds at the Department of Justice and have him call me, and then I can tell them that the department wants me to do this. So I did that. I did that. Called Brad. Brad called the president. The thing was duly scheduled. Of course, it was. But then came the speech, and a lot of difficulty getting the speech through the speechwriters, getting the speechwriters to do the speech. And the night before he was to give the speech, he said to me, we were at a dinner at Kay Graham's house that was supposed to bury the hatchet, and he said to me, I hope you have something good for me to say tomorrow. And I said, well, I don't know, because they don't want you to say it. Who are they? And I said, you know who they are. And he said, yes, I think I do know who they are. So the next morning, he calls up and says, how's it coming? And I said, well, they're giving me a real a problem here. And he said, look, what if I write it? They can't take it out then, can they? And I said, I certainly hope not. And so he wrote it out in longhand in the yellow legal pad. I think John Schmitz purloined the original in gross violation of the Presidential Records Act. And it was better than anything the speechwriters could have come up with or I could have come up with. The speech was a great success, a lot of good press, put the fellow society in a very good light. But then the speech was not allowed to be distributed. Covered the speech with a statement saying, do not distribute. So we got Henry Hyde to put it in the Congressional Record, and that's how we distributed. The Federal Society had 5,000 members then. It has 42,000 now. So you can see what a great success the speech was. Now, so the topic is American exceptionalism, and I assume that exceptionalism from what? Except from what? And I assume you mean a little bit of Europe. I want to say at the outset, though, and people have heard me say this, but I want to say at the outset that I have, in Europe, exceptional protection. And I just want you to know that. I'm safe. Whatever you think about Europe's being soft on terrorism, they clearly are not. They are definitely not. And we have, the U.S. and Europe, a great working relationship in sharing information. And they are very tough on this, whatever your preconceptions, whatever the media says. They're responsible for my safety. The house that I live in was bought from a Russian oligarch who was so worried about his future that he put in the most exquisite safety equipment, triple mylar windows to stop a 50 caliber bullet. But the key thing, I was told twice by my regional, local, Flemish, now they may be a separate country, we don't know, security officers, that the best thing I had were a set guarding my bedroom, a set of 4th century doors. And it took me 2 full briefings to screw up enough courage to ask, what in the hell is a 4th century door? You all must be really curious about a 4th century door. It was thick. They are thick. So they connote thickness. And they are thick. And I said, what is a 4th century door? And I was told by these Flemish guys, a 4th century door is that door which, for 1/2 hour, to allow you to call the police if you're under attack from Al-Qaeda, can withstand anything that could be thrown at it in the 4th century. So you have an image of the battering ram and the catapult and the flaming arrow. And I said to myself when I first heard this, what's so special about the 4th? Why not the 3rd? Why not the 5th? Or even the 20th? You know, I mean, so this, I would tell this story and people would laugh, just as you have very nicely. I appreciate your laughing. And this would warm the crowd up. But then my press officer came to me one day and said, Mr. Ambassador, he's a very sort of mild, meek guy. He said, you must stop talking about the 4th century door. And I said, why? He said, because you're going to bring disgrace upon yourself, our mission, and your country. And I said, why? He said, because there is no such thing as a 4th century door. And I said, but I was briefed and told twice that I have these 4th century doors and what they are all about. And my staff said, but they're wrong. And I said, how do you know? He said, because I've Googled, eBayed, Microsoft, iPodded. I've done everything I can to find anything. There's nothing online, offline, above the line, below the line. There's nothing anywhere about a 4th century door. What do I have? He said, what you have is not a 4th century door, but a forced entry door. So I'm safe. I'm at least safe. No, what I want to talk about briefly, and I know there isn't much time, maybe not enough time, but impressions from Europe. I once asked a leading German writer, journalist, sort of philosopher, publisher, what's the difference between the two economies? I mean, I think he knew why I was asking. And he said, well, you know, the Scottish Enlightenment took off from the British Isles, crossed the Atlantic, dumped 1,000 years of feudalism in the North Atlantic, set up shop in your constitution, where it has flourished ever since. A few bumps here and there, he said, but it could never get across the channel in the opposite direction. Now, I'm not sure I agree with that completely, but it's a good starting point. What does he mean by that? What about the French? I mean, Benjamin Friedman, in his book, The Moral Consequences of Economic Growth, gives Turgot almost equal billing with Adam Smith in terms of building the modern global economy for free markets. And, of course, we had a triumphant visit just very recently by Sarkozy. And Lafayette, of course, helped us with our revolution going way, way back. So what about the continent? What does all this mean? Well, I'll come back to that. Just let me give you a couple of facts. And this, I think, surprises most Americans. It certainly surprised me when I got there, that this partnership, this transatlantic relationship, is really extremely deep. It comprises 60% of the world GDP, 40% of world trade. There's $1 trillion on either side, give or take a billion here and there, of investments. 7 or 8 million jobs on each side, dependent on the other. There are a lot of little factoids in a book by Dan Hamilton, who's at Johns Hopkins, if you want to read it. But there's more U.S. investment in the country of Belgium than there is in the entire country of China. I mean, there are lots of little factoids. Ireland has more investment in Texas than Europe has in the whole of China. I mean, a little factoids like this, which I think would surprise all of you. This is an incredibly deep relationship, and so it's very important to us. And if we go wrong, Europe will suffer. And of course, what I worry about is that Europe goes wrong and we suffer. But however you look at it, we are joined at the hip. So it's important what happens there. The problem is that they are lagging in GDP growth compared to us. Their productivity growth historically is lower. Their educational, counterintuitively, they don't provide anywhere near the same access to college education that we do. They don't have continental Europe now, does not have a single university in the top 20. They don't match our R&D spending. They have no military capacity, in part because they don't have enough money to finance it. This impacts other issues such as Iran sanctions. They're so worried about little contracts in Iran that they're nervous about imposing sanctions, where if their economy were booming, these little contracts wouldn't matter much in the larger scheme of things. It impacts the possibility for Turkic accession because here are 70 million low-wage workers. It's the Turkish plumber. The French are worried. Well, not just French. Many in the continent are worried, but the French especially, about losing their jobs to entrepreneurial Turks. Now, the Turks have been fairly well integrated in Germany, and they're among their best workers, but this is not recognized throughout the rest of Europe. Europe has trouble with internal migration that's supposed to stand for the free flow of people, goods, capital, and services. But when the 15 new countries of the East came in, most of the European countries put in a ban on workers coming in from those countries. It would be like the West saying no workers from the South, or the Northeast saying no one from the South can move into Chicago or to Boston to pick up jobs. It's really quite astonishing. There were three countries that didn't put in these bars on internal migration: Sweden, Great Britain, and Ireland. And it so happens that these three countries have by far the lowest unemployment rates in all of Europe and the fastest economic growth. So you'd think Europe would understand that internal immigration, 800,000 moving into those three countries, would mean something, but it doesn't. It has not seeped in. France has lost 300,000 of the smartest young people to London and New York, and the key test of Sarkozy, in my view, is whether he'll get any of those 300,000 back to Paris. But Paris doesn't offer many job opportunities for young people who are really, really smart. And this is not good. So what's the cause of this? Well, Leonard Leo gave an answer once when he was in Europe. He was asked by some very appreciative parliamentarians that Leonard had spoken to, we need more information about your Madison so that we can better improve our economies here. And Leonard may not remember this, but Leonard said, it's not Madison you want, it's Hamilton. And What Hamilton did, of course, was, with the help of Chief Justice John Marshall, flatten the state interference with our internal market using the Commerce Clause and the Dormant Commerce Clause. And so we have a fairly market-oriented internal market here. But the Europeans have not been able to finish this. And the head of the European Central Bank recently gave a speech saying, we leave a lot of growth on the table because we haven't completed our internal market, especially in services, and we have not finished what's called the Lisbon Agenda, which is a deregulation agenda along the lines of what Reagan launched and actually Carter had launched with Senator Kennedy on transportation deregulation, Justice Breyer. That they have not been able to do this, and that must be done if they are to keep up with us, or at least not infect us with some of their sort of overregulation and protectionism. Now, there are sort of two visions that are kind of emerging in Europe. In order to complete the Lisbon Agenda and to cement this relationship with the United States, Chancellor Merkel started a transatlantic partnership to deregulate down, to harmonize down, to help Europe complete its deregulation, complete its internal market, and cement the relationship with the United States. The first meeting was held last Thursday and Friday. It went extremely well, although it was very, very tough going. But there are vertical discussions over different sectors, agriculture, drugs, environment, and then there's the horizontal effort to harmonize our ability to cost-benefit analysis, regulatory impact analysis. The cost-benefit analysis can be binding on our executive branch, and the courts have approved this, as you all know, the D.C. Circuit, but this is not anywhere near close on the European side. So a lot of work needs to be done, but I am positive. On the other hand, there is a move to make Europe the regulator of the world, and we all see this. Not Microsoft by itself wouldn't necessarily say this, but look at Intel, look at Qualcomm, look at the investigations the competition authorities in Europe are doing at the request of our companies who have run out of remedies in the United States. Now you look at so many things that Europe is doing and doing quite intentionally become the regulator to the world. Part of this is because they can't get their own deregulation done. They impose undue burden, comparative burden, on their own companies. So in order to level the playing field, they level it up by exporting the regulation to us and everybody else. So that's part of it. Another problem is, of course, they have the largest market, consumer market, that's rich, that's buying a lot, 500 million people. And so if you want to market internationally, you basically have to meet the highest standard, and that is the European standard. And Mandelson said not too long ago, he's the trade minister, he's the equivalent of our student Schwab, he said the rules of the single market are the foundation, the rules of the EU single market, are the foundation to export our rules and standards around the world, an increasingly important part of my job. No single market, no European project, and no European puissance. It's not a nice word. I wouldn't use that word, but Peter used it. But the idea is that Europe's power will not come from its military or anything else. It will come, because it doesn't have a military, it will come from its ability to tell the rest of the world how to make their products. Sarkozy himself has raised questions, notwithstanding the great reception he got here. He has said, and I'm quoting him now, competition as an ideology, as a dogma, what has it done for Europe? And he took the competition plank out of the EU Constitution, or so-called treaty that was just adopted. He took it out, the doctrine of free and open competition. And now the British think they got it back into some footnote in an annex somewhere, but it may take 10 years before we know whether any damage was done. Just 2 days ago, Sarkozy reiterated his support for the EU's, quote, community preference, close quote, saying that protection should no longer be taboo. So this is that's a competing version. Now, who's gonna win? People say Sarkozy says this just to throw a sop to his left. Let's hope that's the case. Who's gonna win? I think Merkel's vision will carry the day, but it does depend, I think, on a lot of what you do, because the key to this, at the end of the day, is legal. And You do now have offices, chapters in Europe. I hope you will support them. Leonard's been very good to get them going, but I think they're very, very important. You have lots of allies in the European think tank network, but they need support. But there are a couple of points to remember. Europe has no Administrative Procedure Act. They have no equivalent of the D.C. Circuit. The states, the member states, control access to the courts in terms of appealing and reviewing the regulatory output of Brussels. This is because the states don't want to give up. They want to retain their control. They are themselves vulnerable to buy-off by special interests. And so what we did in our founding was to kind of create the kind of checks and balances you're all familiar with, to lower the influence, to not eliminate, but to reduce the influence of the special interests. This has not happened in Europe. That's why they don't have an internal market for services, why they have so many difficulties, in my opinion, is because the member states still retain too much control. And there is no standing for an individual company or industry or individual consumer to sue in a European Court of Justice to get review of European rules. The European Court of Justice has been like our Supreme Court. It has forged such internal market as Europe has. They've done it because, as one European politician said, we all know what we have to do to restore our competitiveness. We just don't know how to get elected after we've done it. But we shouldn't take, you know, sanctimonious view about that, because frankly our politicians couldn't have done it either. It was really done in the early years by Chief Justice Marshall. And the idea, much of our doctrine of court independence stems from the period back when Hamilton wanted to make sure that the court had the authority to stuff the states, especially his own state of New York. So hopefully the Merkel vision will prevail, but the lawyers, in terms of procedural rights, cost-benefit analysis, review in the courts of bad things that happen. Can you imagine? I don't know what the data are, but I think maybe a third of the U.S. regulatory output is thrown out by the D.C. Circuit. Think of how much better Europe would be if a third of it went by the wayside, but it doesn't. Now, this is not to say that we're all great on all these things. We have our problems, too. Trial lawyers and is a well-known example. We need to really work on this. We're losing our competitiveness to London. I asked the former vice chairman of J.P. Morgan, a great friend of mine, college classmate, roommate, how would you apportion the damage done to our financial services by the tort problem, the securities law problem versus Sarbanes-Oxley? Is it 50-50, 60-40, 40-60? What's the ratio? And he said it's 90-10. It's 90% trial lawyer, 10% Sarbanes-Oxley. So this is a real problem for us. And I've said to the Europeans, the grand bargain that would seal our long-term relationship, that would solve the problems, such problems as do exist, the Merkel Initiative, make it go smoother, that would create a seamless market, that would be free and open competition. The way to do this is to trade to Europe our trial lawyers and take the French farmer back in return. And I made this suggestion to a high-ranking German official not long after I got to Brussels. I was in Berlin, and she stared at me for what was a painfully long period of time. And I thought maybe I'd be going back to the United States sooner than I'd planned. And then she finally spoke, and she said, if you take the German farmer as well, you have a deal. So we do need to deal with this issue. Another issue on the other side of the coin is CEO pay and the incentive structure. I don't know whether greater shareholder rights is what to do. The SEC is grappling with that now as we speak. But there is this problem of what I think is called the trader's option. It's sort of like the moral hazard. If you're a CEO of a company, you can take a big gamble, because if you win, you get part of the benefit in stock options and whatnot of any gains the company gets. If you lose your big gamble, what do you lose? The shareholders take the whole burden, or the public, or the taxpayer. But you lose nothing. You may lose your job, but you'll walk off with a couple of $100 million in severance pay. So the incentives are not right, and I shouldn't be critical of our own business community, maybe, but I do think that we have to get the incentives right, that there has to be something so that the big companies don't don't torque the system. Adam Smith was very suspicious of businessmen. You know, the famous quote, no two businessmen can get together without conspiring against the public interest. And we need to watch this kind of incestuous relationship, not incestuous, but we need to watch our disruption of our own internal market. And protectionism can arise here in the United States just as easily as it does in Europe. We need to watch that very carefully. I worry about the loss of Doha. I worry about the Democrats blocking various bilateral trade deals. So we need to be very, very careful, and we lawyers can have a lot to say about that. We are not pure in this country. We are not holding up our end of the exceptionalism that is a gift in many ways of Adam Smith and the Scottish Enlightenment, which did inform Madison and Jefferson and Franklin were all very much aware of Adam Smith. His book, Wealth of Nations, was published in 1776. It was a good year for freedom, and we have a responsibility to keep that going. So thank you very much. And I'll answer any questions that you have.
Ambassador, thank you very much. We will be seeing you a little bit later this morning during our presentation by Justice Thomas. And I guess you'll be around a little bit this morning if people would like to talk to you a little bit about housing a French or German farmer for a summer. We don't have any space ourselves, but you know, maybe somebody else can do it. We're going to move right into the next panel. So people should just keep their seats. And if the panelists would please step up to the platform.